Imagine that you and I were having a therapy session, and there was a magic button on my desk. If you pressed the button, all your problems would suddenly disappear with absolutely no effort on your part, and you'd walk out of today's session feeling wonderful. Would you press that button? The obvious answer is yes, of course I'd press that button. But many people have the opposite reaction. They're reluctant to press the button. Even though their suffering is real, they have mixed feelings about change, so they cling to the status quo. Traditionally, therapists have called this puzzling phenomenon resistance. In this chapter, you're going to learn how to pinpoint the hidden forces that may be keeping you stuck. Once you expose these hidden forces to the light of day, often they'll lose their power to defeat you. I once treated a young man named Sam who worked at a fast food restaurant in Washington, D.C. One night, two armed gunmen broke in and robbed him at gunpoint just as he was locking up. Then, they locked him in the restaurant's walk-in freezer and left him there to freeze to death before they ran off with the money. The next morning, the manager discovered Sam huddled and shivering in the freezer, barely alive and badly traumatized. Months later, Sam came to me for treatment with all the classic symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. He'd recovered physically, but was still consumed by intense feelings of anxiety and rage. Vivid, terrifying memories of the incident popped into his mind unexpectedly. These flashbacks made Sam feel panicky, helpless, and vulnerable. He also had fantasies of getting revenge on the men who robbed him. Sam was miserable every waking minute of every day and desperately wanted to get his life back. I told Sam that even though he'd been through a terrifying and humiliating experience, the prognosis for full recovery was bright. I explained that his negative feelings resulted from the frightening thoughts and vivid fantasies that were constantly flowing across his mind, and told him that many powerful new techniques could help him change the way he was thinking and feeling. With a little luck and hard work, his anxiety and anger might even disappear completely. I thought Sam would be thrilled to hear that message, but instead, he insisted that my techniques couldn't possibly help and began fighting me tooth and nail. I suddenly felt more like his enemy than his ally. Sam was miserable and desperate for relief, but when I offered to help him, he started arguing with me. Why was Sam resisting me? To find out, I suggested we try a cost-benefit analysis, CBA, a motivational technique that will help you pinpoint the forces that keep you stuck. You list all the advantages and disadvantages of a thought, feeling, or habit that's causing problems for you. Then, you balance the advantages against the disadvantages so you can make a more enlightened decision about whether you want to change or not. I asked Sam if he could think of any advantages of feeling constantly anxious and angry. Sam came up with quite a few advantages. First, he believed that his anxiety would keep him vigilant and protect him from further harm. This is a common belief among individuals who struggle with anxiety. I call it magical thinking. It's the idea that even though your anxiety is painful, it's protecting or helping you in some way. There were also some hidden benefits of Sam's anger. It showed that Sam was strong and not about to let a couple of thugs push him around and get away with it. His revenge fantasies showed that he had a sense of pride and self-esteem and wasn't going to let two sadistic gunmen walk all over him. The advantages of Sam's anxiety and anger made it clear why he was resisting treatment. He wasn't being irrational, ornery, or stubborn. And he wasn't trying to defeat me. From his perspective, he felt like he was simply being responsible, moral, manly, and realistic. Then I asked Sam if he could think of any disadvantages of constantly feeling anxious. Was there a price he was paying for feeling that way? Sam listed some pretty compelling disadvantages, such as the fact that he felt miserable every waking minute of every day. He also questioned the notion that his anxiety would protect him from danger or help him cope more effectively in the unlikely event that he was robbed again. Was there also a downside to Sam's anger? It dawned on Sam that the gunman didn't even know he was angry, so he was only punishing himself with his constant rage and revenge fantasies. It was his life that was going down the drain, not theirs. I asked Sam to weigh the advantages of the constant anxiety and anger against the disadvantages on a 100-point scale. Did the benefits or the costs feel greater? Even though he'd listed more advantages, Sam decided that the disadvantages were greater. So he put a 70 in the circle on the right and a 30 in the circle on the left. Sometimes one strong disadvantage will outweigh several advantages, or vice versa. As a homework assignment, I suggested that Sam might want to go to the local police station and ask if they had any tips on how to avoid being mugged or robbed, since he lived in a dangerous neighborhood. The officer at the desk gave him a brochure with 8 excellent safety tips on how to avoid being attacked. Sam was surprised to discover that constant worrying was not one of the recommended methods. When I saw Sam the next week, he'd had a real change of attitude. His resistance had disappeared, and we began working together as a team. After just a few sessions, Sam's anxiety and anger disappeared completely, and he was ready to terminate his treatment. Sam's story illustrates how resistance works. On some level, you may not want to recover, even if recovery requires absolutely no effort on your part. Of course, for each person and problem, the reasons for resisting change will be somewhat different. For example, if you suffer from test anxiety, you may constantly worry that your mind will go blank or that you'll freeze up when you take your final exam. But you may also believe that the anxiety is the price you have to pay to do really good work. You may think that the constant worrying will motivate you to work hard and do your best. There is a grain of truth to this. A small amount of anxiety can be motivating, but you rapidly reach a point of diminishing returns. Too much anxiety can cripple you. I've found that I do my best work when I'm feeling relaxed and confident, not when I'm worried or anxious. Alternatively, you may want to overcome your fears, but may not want to do what you're going to have to do to get the job done. The price of recovery may seem too high. There's one thing that every anxious individual will have to do that he or she absolutely won't want to do to get well. If you want to overcome your anxiety, you're going to have to face your fears and confront the monster you fear the most. Of course, exposure to the thing you fear isn't the only tool we're going to use, but exposure will be an important part of our treatment plan, and it will be scary at first. It always requires tremendous courage and determination. I once treated a 31-year-old man named Trevor, who hadn't had a date in over 5 years. This was surprising to me because he was a tall, handsome fellow, and he was friendly and charming. Why was such a handsome, personable fellow having so much trouble getting a date? It turned out that Trevor had a tendency to sweat a great deal and felt intensely self-conscious because he was convinced that any woman would be disgusted when she saw the circles of sweat on his shirt under his armpits. He was so worried about sweating that he'd become almost housebound, especially during the summer months. Trevor said he was tired of being lonely and wanted to get his social life in gear. I asked what it would be worth to him if I agreed to show him how to do this. He said he was desperate and would do practically anything to make that happen. That was the message I was hoping to hear. I told Trevor that I wanted to schedule a double session with him so that we could go outdoors and do some shame-attacking exercises instead of just talking in the office. I explained that when you do a shame-attacking exercise, you do something foolish in public on purpose so you can see that the world doesn't really come to an end. I warned Trevor that the shame attacking exercises would probably be frightening, but might help him overcome his fears. The following Tuesday, Trevor showed up at 2 p.m. for his double session. It was August in Philadelphia, and it was especially hot and humid that day. As we were leaving the hospital to do our shame-attacking exercises, I stopped by the clinical lab, borrowed a plastic squirt bottle, and filled it with water. Once we were outside, I told Trevor that we were going to jog to the local convenience store to work up a little sweat. He looked nervous, but agreed, so off we went. When we arrived at the store a few minutes later, we were both pretty sweaty. I told Trevor I wanted to squirt his armpits with water to make it look like he was totally soaked in sweat. I said that I also wanted to pour water on his head so it would look like sweat was literally dripping from his face. Once he was soaked, I wanted him to go inside the store and stand near the cash register where everyone could see him. Then I wanted him to place his right hand on the back of his head with his elbow pointed to the side so his sweaty armpit would be completely exposed, point to his armpit with his left hand and say, loudly enough so everyone in the store could hear him, "Boy, it sure is hot today. Look at me. I'm sweating like a pig." Trevor was terrified and couldn't believe what I was asking him to do. He insisted that he couldn't possibly do it because everyone in the store would be totally grossed out when they saw how sweaty and disgusting he was. I reminded him that he'd promised to do whatever it took, even if it was frightening. I told him that this was the price he had to pay if he really wanted to defeat his fears and change his life. We debated the merits of the shame-attacking exercise for several minutes. Should he or shouldn't he? Finally, Trevor said, "Okay, if you think it's so easy, I'd like to see you do it." I said, "Sure, no problem." I squirted my armpits and face with copious amounts of water and went into the store with water dripping from my head. I put my hand on the back of my head, pointed to my armpit, and loudly declared how hot and sweaty I was. The people in the store didn't seem terribly interested and just went about their business. It was almost as if I were invisible. I went back outside and told Trevor it was his turn. He looked terrified, swallowed hard, and went for it. Once again, no one seemed repulsed or shocked by his sweaty armpits. The only difference was that he was so handsome that several people in the store started talking to him. It was as if they'd found a long-lost friend. Trevor could barely believe what had happened. Then we jogged to several other stores in the neighborhood, taking turns doing our shame-attacking exercises. People seemed amused by our sweaty antics. No one seemed put off. Many people chatted with us about how hot it was. This was a revelation to Trevor. He was shocked that we kept getting such friendly reactions from everyone. We finally ended up in a boutique that sold fashionable women's sportswear. I noticed an attractive young woman giving Trevor the eye, but he was totally oblivious and didn't seem to be aware of her. I told him to approach her, put his hand on his head, point to his armpit, and make his sweaty proclamation again. He became intensely resistant and insisted that he couldn't possibly do that because she'd be totally grossed out. I told him that this was exactly what he had to do if he wanted to gain liberation from his fears. This would be his graduation exercise. I promised I wouldn't ask him to do any more shame-attacking exercises if he'd just do it this one last time. He reluctantly approached her, pointed to his armpit, and shyly commented about how sweaty he was. She didn't seem at all concerned about his sweat, but seemed extremely pleased that he was talking to her. Soon, they were deeply engrossed in conversation. After a few minutes, she suggested that it might be fun to get together for coffee sometime. Trevor looked dumbfounded and said it sounded like a great idea. She said, "Then you'll need my phone number so you can give me a call." She scribbled it on a piece of paper, pressed it into the palm of his hand, and said, "Call me soon." Trevor walked out of that store on cloud nine. He was speechless. Why were the shame-attacking exercises so effective? Trevor discovered that his negative thoughts were completely off base. The moment he stopped believing what he'd been telling himself, his shyness was ancient history.